Welcome back to Debbie Heath, our perennial audiobook discusser. We've not been able to do one of these for a long time, which is a shame, but what with COVID and everything else, life has been more difficult. However, we're back in the studio, and Debbie and I have been looking at and listening to a book by Sue Townsend called The Woman Who Went to Bed for a Year. We'll come back to the title in a minute. But first, Debbie, thanks for being here. And the life story of Sue Townsend is quite interesting. You know, her father was a factory worker who became a postman. The mother worked in the canteen at a factory. She, the mother, encouraged her daughter to read. Apparently, she got her job lot of Just William books, sort of jumble sale or something, and she got her reading that. Something else that I discovered was that rather unfortunate that she, Sue Townsend, as a child, witnessed the murder of another school child, someone she knew.
This is horrible. Do you know how old she was when...
Less than 14, because she started writing in secret at the age of 14, and that may well have been part of what...
Yeah.
I suspect from what it was written that it was a primary school. I think it was that far back.
Goodness.
Don't know the story. Anyway, she didn't exactly excel at school. She got through. She worked after school in a pea factory. And by evening, she worked at a petrol station. Now, that's a good way to get through the books, because petrol stations at night may not be very pleasant to be in.
Absolutely.
They're rather cold and dark at times and quite lonely. But as long as they're safe, she was able to read a lot during the night shift. She married, 3 kids. The marriage ended. She then really fell into poverty, struggling to put food on the table.
Yes, and I hadn't appreciated that until I read up on it. Goodness. Yeah. But all this gives colour to her books, doesn't it? You know, having a range of jobs like that. She did end up with an honorary degree, I think, didn't she? From a couple of the Leicester...
Yeah, a couple. Colleges. I think it was Leicester, which is where she spent most of her life. And she did a lot of her work in Leicester in the local theatre. And Loughborough was the other one, which is also fairly local to there. Yes, she had a couple of honorary degrees because she wrote a lot. She had a lot of success. I mean, her first one was the well-known series on Adrian Mole.
Oh, loved that.
Which I never read.
Oh, they're marvellous.
I mean, it's a teenage boy growing up with angst.
Just so funny. I mean, it's surprising she wrote as a boy, isn't it? But I suppose she had her own sons, so she knew what she was talking about.
That's right.
Yes, it's through Adrian's eyes, but it's a story of his parents as well. Some of it's so sad and some of it's so funny. What I like about them, it's not just the teenage stuff going on, but it's this lovely friendship that Adrian forms with a retired couple. And it's just this lovely friendship that springs up. Hey, we're not there to talk about
that. No, we must move on. But all this is relevant to the book we are going to discuss. Just to sort of close down on her life a little bit, because she died in 2014, so it's not that long ago. She was diabetic, and that caused her sight loss before she finished writing. And she actually dictated her last books to her son, which she found very strange and very unsatisfying.
Yeah.
But she was ill for quite a long time and in the last years. And as I say, she died in 2014. But in 2012, the book we are going to discuss was voted Audiobook of the Year. And I think it's great fun. Some of the language is sometimes a little bit close to the edge, but that's life. The Woman Who Went to Bed for a Year is called Eva.
I changed my mind about Eva as it went on. We meet Eva as... a housewife who's super intelligent, probably autistic, in a very high-functioning way. Her very intelligent children have just gone to university, twins. And as I'm sure the parents of any twins will know, I believe it's very, very hard work. She has been exhausted for 17 years. She's been serving them. She's been serving her husband. I don't think she had a career, did she? She's been there to serve.
Because the twins are going away, so her life has changed.
Yes, empty nest.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the book, she ends up spilling some soup on a beautifully upholstered chair. She'd upholstered it herself. And this is enough just to make her want to lie down for a minute. Well, I get that. I'm a busy mother. I understand. At this point, I understand Eva. And I think, yeah, good for you. The thing is, though, that she doesn't get out of bed again for a year. And I do begin to lose my patience with her. But I understand where the angst comes from. And no, it's not angst. She's just tired. She's tired of everything.
It also becomes not just a rejection of all the painful things she's had to do over the years, the long list of jobs that need doing and that's assumed that she as the housewife will do.
Hmm.
On the second day, Eva woke and threw the duvet back and sat on the side of the bed. Then she remembered that she didn't have to get up and make breakfast for anyone. Yell at anyone else to get up, empty the dishwasher or fill the washing machine. Iron a pile of laundry, drag a vacuum cleaner up the stairs or sort cupboards and drawers, clean the oven or wipe various surfaces, including the necks of the brown and red sauce bottles, polish the wooden furniture, clean the windows or mop the floors, straighten the rugs and cushions, shove a brush down various shitty toilets or pick up soiled clothing and place it in a laundry basket, replace light bulbs and toilet rolls, pick up things from downstairs that were upstairs and bring them down or pick up things from upstairs that were downstairs, fetch dry cleaning, weed the borders, visit garden centres to buy bulbs and annuals, polish shoes or take them to the key cutter, return library books, sort recycling, pay paper bills, visit one mother and worry about not visiting one mother-in-law, feed the fish and clean out the filter, answer the phone for two teenagers and pass on messages, shave legs or pluck eyebrows, give self-manicure, change the sheets and pillowcases on three beds if it was Saturday, hand wash woolen jumpers and dry flat on a bath towel, pay bills, shop for food she wouldn't eat herself, wheel it to the car, unload it into the boot, drive home, put the food away in the fridge and the cupboards and, on tiptoe, place tins and dried goods on a shelf that exceeded her reach but was perfectly comfortable for Brian.
She didn't go to bed for the day. She was tired. She didn't go there saying, I'm not going to get up for a year. It just sort of became something she thought, well, actually, I don't have to. She hadn't thought it all through because you've got to get to the loo from the bed. But
yeah, we'll come back to that bit. I'm still confused about that bit. Okay.
But I thought that, I mean, the description of the jobs, that it goes on over several pages. So all we can do is listen to a small section of it, what she was saying. I've had enough of all of this. So she's got this family. She doesn't evidently feel particularly appreciated, and certainly as we meet her husband, we begin to understand why, and why she doesn't appreciate him very much. Everything about her past has got her irritated, it seems to me. I mean, I don't have... We'll discuss what your problem with her in a moment, because I think there's darkness beneath the humour, as it were, and it's the darkness that I think is quite interesting.
Yes, I agree. It is dark. I've listened to it twice. I'd never describe it, actually, as a comedy. I would call it a drama that happens to have some wry looks at people and situations. I'm not surprised it won an award as an audiobook, Rob, because Caroline Quentin, I love Caroline Quentin, she's good at so many things, but comedy is her forte, and she just has a way of reading that makes this book come alive. It's an absolute joy to listen to her. So, yeah, if there's comedy, she finds it. She's got all the voices sorted. It's just lovely. She hits the ground running, making it very clear that she understands, well, she's a mother, that she understands some of what Eva's going through.
But her husband, Brian, finds it all completely confusing.
Why are you walking backwards, Brian? She laughed. You look as if you've just laid a wreath at the cenotaph. The answer to Eva's question was that Brian no longer felt safe to turn his back on her. She was no longer the compliant woman he had married, and he feared her mockery, her two fingers gesturing behind his back. He couldn't allow that, especially not after his recent humiliation at work, when Mrs. Horden, the cleaner, had discovered Titania and himself engaged in a sex act involving a model of the Large Hadron Collider. Brian said, I'm glad you find it amusing. Haven't you noticed that my health is suffering? And, unbearably, my paper on Olympus Mons has been discredited by Professor Lichtenstein. I'm on the edge, Eva. You look all right to me. Energetic. Virile. Positively brimming with testosterone. Brian looked at his wife. Virile? I'm exhausted. Why does housework take up so much time?
I think at the beginning, when poor Brian is completely bewildered that he can't get into his own bed, you know, and then he stubs his foot, doesn't he? And I felt really sorry for him. But then, without ruining too much, very quickly, you no longer feel sorry for him. This guy is... Oh, I can't think of a way of saying it politely. Yeah,
he has his own life.
He does.
He's not that interested in anybody other than himself.
I think his children probably take after him. Very, very intelligent man, probably lacking in a great deal of social awareness and a great deal of responsibility, actually. And it was probably highly irritating for her. I think he probably gets what he deserves.
And we can't say too much because as the story develops, of course, you find out more about him and more about what his life is like, what he's up to. the twins, again, pretty asocial mathematical prodigies. Yeah.
When they got to the students' union, they headed straight for the mathematics club. They pushed through the crowds of drunken students and eventually stood in front of a trestle table covered in large, laminated, photocopied equations. A youth wearing a tight-knitted hat gasped and said, "Oh, you're the Beaver twins! Oh, huge respect! You two dudes are awesome! No, no, you're legends! A gold medal each at the IMO!" He looked at Brian Jr. and said, "And the special prize, mega respect! A solution of outstanding elegance. Can you talk me through it? It would be an honour." Brian Jr. said, "Well, yes, if you've got a spare 2 hours." The youth in the hat said, "Listen, anytime, anywhere, a tutorial from Brian Beaver Jr. would look superb on my CV. Let me get a pen."
Brian Jr. and I don't know how you pronounce
Brianne.
It, Brianne.
Yeah.
Everything works around Brian, including the names. They go off to university the first year. They're really going to struggle because they don't really know how to handle people.
No, and they unfortunately meet this terrible girl called Poppy, who is a drain. And I wanted to slap her big time pretty much every 10 minutes throughout the book. But there are people like that that you meet. And if you lack social awareness, it's very hard to deal with people like this, isn't it? And to be honest, I think I'd find it hard to deal with Poppy. But what an interesting character. She becomes quite important and she helps just about everyone in the book to work out who they are one way or another. But terrible, terrible person.
She gets into everything.
Yeah.
And entirely
really
for
does.
Her own interests.
Yes.
She's really not interested in anybody else. She tells lies frequently, all the time, in fact. She lives a lie.
Yeah.
But there we are. She's another great character. In due course, and not too long after, because one of the things that Eva wants to do with her bedroom is clear it all out, get rid of all the furniture, make it white, painted white. Everything's got to be clear, and the old life's gone. She can see out the window. I can't remember whether she moves her bed to the window.
I think she does.
No, she does.
Yeah.
So she can see outside. There's a tree, and gradually people begin to collect once they didn't know what's going on. People come there to find out what's happening, and she has a crowd outside most of the time. Somebody comes to help. Is the white van man by the name of Alexander.
Oh, Alexander, I think he comes to do something else. I think Brian gets him to do something and she says, you know, when you finish, will you come upstairs? I've got a little job for you.
When Eva heard Alexander's voice in the hall, she shouted, "Upstairs! Second on the right!" He smiled a greeting when he saw her. "Am I in the right place?" "Yes," she said, and indicated the wardrobe. He looked at it and laughed. "Yeah, I can see why you'd want to get rid of that. It's like a wooden Stonehenge." He opened the doors and looked inside. The wardrobe was still jammed with Brian and Eva's clothes and shoes. "Are you going to empty it?" "No," she said. "I have to stay in or on the bed."
"Sorry, I didn't realise you were ill."
"No," she said, "I'm not ill. I'm just retreating from the world, I think."
"Yeah? Well, we all have our own way of doing that. So, will you be staying in bed?"
She said, "I have to."
"And where do you want me to put the clothes and shoes?"
It took hours to empty her side of the wardrobe. They developed a system. Alexander got 4 large bin liners from the kitchen. One was for recycling, another for charity shops, a third for selling on eBay, and the last was to take to the vintage clothing shop that Alexander's sister ran in the newly fashionable Deptford.
And poor Alexander, well, he never really escapes, does he?
He's a lovely character. I found him very interesting and
yes.
Very lovely because he used to work in banking. He dropped out of banking. He's another, if you like, outsider. He grows his dreadlocks and he is what he is and he's a great character. And he's actually very caring towards her.
He's lovely. Yes, I don't think she could have managed it without Alexander and the 2 grandmothers. But we could come on to them a bit later. Yes. Alexander's a very interesting character, and there's some really sad stuff near the end that I found deeply affecting. Marvellous person. He's extremely patient, and he ends up, well, really mothering her. The bit I didn't like, Rob, and I have a problem with nail clipping at the best of times. The bit where Sue Townsend describes him cutting Eva's toenails. It made me, and I feel sick now, actually.
We won't talk about it anymore, though.
Yeah.
There are certain aspects of this which are, if you like, have the potential to do that to you.
Yes.
That's part of the comedy that comes out of a situation that is not itself comic. And there's a lot that develops. And you mentioned the two mothers, or the mother and the mother-in-law.
They're very different women. And they end up doing an awful lot for Eva as well. This is where I start to have a problem with her. I completely sympathise, but I just think there comes a point where she's being utterly selfish. The older women really are much too old to be doing all this heavy work for her. But the problem is, of course, she is mentally ill, and she's not receiving the support that she needs. There's some dragon of a district nurse that comes in and doesn't like her at all. But it's terribly sad that the system has failed her, but I believe this is what's happening.
She is disturbed, and superficially, who wouldn't be by the life she's put up with? And she reflects the life of a lot of other people, mainly women, who are in that situation as well. Taken for granted, doing all the work and thinking, what am I doing this for? There are other characters, of course, which emerge, and some of them are quite nice. And interesting things happen. And as I said, there's a crowd gathers outside and that becomes itself a feature.
Yes, because they regard her as a sage, really, don't they? That's they right. all want a piece of advice,
yeah.
which puts all the pressure on her again. I'm not sure she always gives the best advice, but there we are.
The thing is that it's a book which is enjoyable. I found it humorous. You worry about the humour aspect, whether it should be seen as humorous, but it is.
It is funny.
Yeah. Caroline Quentin is a hoot reading it. It's a good listen.
It's an easy book to listen to. It is a funny book, darkly comic, and it will also give you some social questions to consider, won't it? So, yeah, if you want a book that will make you think a little bit, then why not go for it? I mean, I have visual impairment, so I had to listen to it, and I went through it in about a week. It was an absolute pleasure. Thoroughly recommend this book. She's a very funny writer. She's very shrewd. She really understands people and a range of people, probably because of this very varied life she's had. And she knows what it's like to be in poverty. She knows what it's like to have a range of jobs. It comes through. And it's particularly rewarding knowing that she suffered from sight loss as we do. Yeah, it's just really uplifting, isn't it?
Thank you very much, Debbie. Debbie and I were talking about the audiobook The Woman Who Went to Bed for a Year by Sue Townsend. It was recorded by Caroline Quentin, and the recording lasts for 10.5 hours. Thanks as ever to Caliber Audio for enabling us to take extracts from the recording to illustrate the points we were trying to make.